when we think about mental health literacy, what does that even mean? It means being able to recognize that there's a challenge, whether it's with yourself, a loved one, somebody in the community, a colleague, to be able to acknowledge that someone's not okay, I'm not okay, I'm not myself, all of those things. And then what are the tools and resources available to get help? And then the other piece of it is, what could we do to prevent a mental health challenge in the first place?
Hi, guys. I'm Laura Koons. Welcome back to Prevention Pioneers. Today, we have Shira Walensky. So Shira is with One Digital, and she is the national practice leader for health and well-being at One Digital, which is a big title, and she's had a big career. But Shira, I want to start with you telling the audience not just what you do, but what you're about. If you had to say, I'm Shira, and this is what I'm about in my career, what is that?
My husband would introduce me as a glorified aerobics instructor, I think. And my brother, who is a vascular surgeon, would introduce me as a wannabe doctor that can't help anybody.
Oh, gosh.
Went to school for my PhD. But what am I all about? From a very young age, growing up in a family of physicians and hating the doctor and needles myself, there is so much that we cannot control in this life. I'm about helping people do everything that they possibly can to do their best work and live their best life.
Holy moly. Okay. What a great summary, because, I mean, could we have a better guest on Prevention Pioneers? That's why we do what we do, because it is so true. The knowledge is very, very powerful. And I think it's interesting too, because we're now in a day and age where everybody is yearning for that knowledge. But when you first got into this, that probably wasn't the case. So let's talk about that, how it's evolved since you, because how long have you been in the corporate mental well, or not well, the corporate well-being space?
Yes. Okay. So I transitioned from aerobics instructor, personal trainer into the health insurance industry, if you will, in 2005. So it's been a minute. And corporate wellness at that time really was putting in a program that's designed to better manage your healthcare costs. And that translated down into better managing your chronic conditions, hypertension, high cholesterol, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and the success of those programs was measured based on claims costs. So these programs were really only offered to large self-funded employers, and they were only offered to the employees that were on the health plan because those were the ones that were going to cost you money. Fast forward to not just from an industry perspective, but I think it's bigger than that, to really look at what does it mean to bring your best self to work every day? As an example, I just lost my dad. Is that going to show up in my claims costs from a medical perspective? Probably not. Is that going to impact my ability to show up from a performance productivity perspective and really the ability to do my best work? Sure it is. And everybody has challenges, life's challenges that they're trying to navigate at the same time. So when we think about what does it mean now to support our employees from a health and well-being perspective, it's really looking at that whole person.
In the last 5 years, I think really blew the lid off of that. And employers became willing to do that too. You know, it wasn't just certain employees who had certain experiences that were saying, I don't feel supported or I can't show up. I feel like 10 years ago, that same employee would have taken completely different actions than they would take today because the stigma has lessened.
Absolutely.
Which we can credit the pandemic with.
Yes.
So let's talk about that, how you've seen the stigma lessen with employers in terms of mental health, and then where you still see it exist? And do you draw any correlations there with the fact that we have this multi-generational workforce, five generations, and each one has a different mentality around it? So what do you see there?
Okay, that was a lot of questions.
That's a lot. It's loaded. Let's unpack it one piece at a time.
Okay. So from a generational perspective, we can start there, right?
Okay.
I think that what we've seen is, from a stigma perspective, is that there are folks, and this is also certainly attributed to COVID as well, it is okay to not be okay.
Yeah.
And so one of the biggest barriers from an employer perspective that we used to have is people not admitting that they needed help. And what we saw during COVID is it was okay to not be okay. So now people are asking for help. Well, now from an employer perspective, it becomes, well, what are you doing about it? And at that time, it was the house is on fire, right? So it was do it, anything we can to help our people because they are struggling, suffering. Anything is better than nothing. But
yeah,
we've come a bit of a ways from that. And now it's, okay, what can we do that's really going to be the most meaningful, the most impactful? What is it that our people really need? What do they really want? What do they really value? From a generational perspective, we do see that some of the younger generations are more comfortable. It's more acceptable. When we look at the percentages of diagnoses with actual mental health conditions, there's been a significant increase there,
right,
as well.
Right.
And so it's something that people are more comfortable talking about, as opposed to some of the older generations. It was perceived as a weakness, right? It would lead to concern about one's ability to perform their job. I think hopefully we're closing that gap.
And one thing on that note is actually, someone told me last week, I believe it was a brokerage firm, that on their side, they're seeing mental health related medication claims absolutely through the roof. Because, and we talk a lot about that here, that it's almost like the pendulum swung in the opposite direction and everything's getting a diagnosis, or because people are so open to getting the help, you know, but don't have the education necessarily on what help to get. It's like, okay, COVID hits and everybody runs to the emergency room, right? And mental health stigma shifts and everybody's getting a therapist, or everybody's getting an anxiety diagnosis or a depression diagnosis. Now, I'm not saying that providers would ever be irresponsible and give somebody a diagnosis that doesn't need it, but not everybody goes to the proper provider to get the proper diagnosis. And we see that, you know, my background's behavioral healthcare, 16 years. And, you know, really what I did for all those years in behavioral healthcare is I was a care navigator. You know, I was on the front lines and the residential treatment world, and I would be the first phone call, or the team that I would run would be the first phone call for a lawyer who had a family with a DUI situation, or for a therapist who identified that somebody needed the higher level of care, but they didn't know what to do and where to send them. So like through that lens, and you really look at, I heard you say in another podcast that care navigation, for example, is something that an employer should not do without, right? And it's like for those reasons, because there really is a science behind what kind of care and what kind of help and what kind of intervention each person needs.
Yes.
Along the full spectrum of mental wellness down through mental illness.
Yes. And I think one of the solves there is when we think about mental health literacy, what does that even mean?
Yeah.
It means being able to recognize that there's a challenge, whether it's with yourself, a loved one, somebody in the community, a colleague, to be able to acknowledge that something's not okay. Someone's not okay. I'm not okay. I'm not myself. All of those things. And then what are the tools and resources available to get help? And then the other piece of it is, you know, what could we do to prevent a mental health challenge in the first place?
Right.
So that piece, I think the care navigation piece plays into the management. Like, okay, I'm acknowledging that I'm not okay. Now what do I do?
Right.
Like, once you take that first step, like, uncle, okay, like, now what?
It is very tough. And I mean, you know, we started this conversation talking about the medication claims, you know, going through the roof for employers. And, you know, it is tough because it's like the average person doesn't know what to do. You know, they really would not know what to do. Like, I know at Spirence, we've, you know, built content around helping people understand what a mental health condition actually looks like or what normal is. There's a certain level of stress. There's a certain level of symptoms that actually is the norm. And especially in today's day and age, when, you know, we're being forced to increase in resilience and we're being forced to actually expand our capacity because life moves so fast. It's so intense. Like these new generations, right? It's like so much. And if they don't build that resilience, you know, what does that look like long term? They're just all on chronic mental health medications because the anxiety is too high.
When you were talking about your experience in behavioral health care, I could not help but draw the parallel between obesity and the medication without the lifestyle changes to go along with it. One could argue that there is some commonality there between mental health issues and the medication, while oftentimes justified and needed without the therapy component. I would argue same thing, the lifestyle changes to go along with it from a supportive perspective.
Oh gosh, that's a really great correlation. Really great correlation, because there's also that educational piece that a lot of people miss. It's like they kind of don't want to know. And I find it with the same with mental health, they don't even know that it's part of it. When really, like, cognitive behavioral therapy has two parts. It has literacy.
Yes.
And it has the actual cognitive behavioral therapy, the rewiring of the brain, the rewiring of the thoughts, and that the work that you'll do with the therapist. So because I know you have a background in health literacy. So because you just drew that correlation really quickly. So talk to me about the power that you've seen of health literacy for organizations. And then do you see a trending need towards them being open to mental health literacy? Like, where do you see all this now?
When we think about health outcomes, I'll start there. The data tells us that 80% of health outcomes are driven by social determinants of health, which is, where do people live, work, and play? And some of the determinants of health are things like access to care, health literacy, environment. All of those things from an overall health perspective come into play when we think about it's not just literal access to care, right? In terms of, is there a doctor within XYZ radius? But are you able to get yourself to work, get care for your children, for example, to be able to go to an appointment? Or are you able to take time away from work to actually get access to care? Those things also relate to a mental health perspective. When we think about traditional health literacy, it's people being able to make informed choices. We're not talking about the people that know that they have a challenge and they're not in a place from a stages of change perspective where they're ready to do something about it. It's the people that may not even know, understand, or realize that there's a problem and may not know what to do next once that they identify that there's an issue. And we've started to talk about literacy in the context specifically of mental health literacy, financial literacy as well.
Right. Yes. Yes.
So it's all related. And no, we're not going to be able to change everybody. But when we think about moving the needle, it's for the people that don't have the power of knowledge, education, and information. How can we at least solve for those barriers simply through informing them? And that's where the navigation piece can come into play. Targeted communications, right?
Right.
And languages and modalities that are really tailored to the uniqueness of your workforce. I think all of those things come into play.
Oh, gosh, that's so true. I mean, and going back to the conversation about the generations in the workforce, I think the language aspect is really powerful there because you have a boomer who will never use a mental wellness product, but they might use a resilience tool. You know, they might use a stress management tool. You have, you have a Gen Z. Then you have us. I think we're in the same generation.
Yes, you know, I'm just too.
In our 40s, and we're kind of like the bridge.
The bridge, and then also in a lot of cases, we fall smack into that sandwich generation as well.
Right, and I definitely want to get into the sandwich generation. But on this note, being the bridge or the sandwich generation, what do you think for like middle management today? Because I feel like a lot of people in our generation find ourselves in middle management or executive leadership. But I just think middle managers today have it really hard because number one, like they're not choosing the benefits that their company rolls out.
Right.
So they don't have that say. What do you think about middle managers today? Like just...
They're the front line because they're managing their own mental health. And they're also the face of the company. And then they're the first line of defense in terms of employees coming to them with challenges or issues. They're also going to be the first ones likely to recognize or acknowledge that somebody might be experiencing a mental health challenge. So they are in a tough spot. I can say this, if you've thought about implementing a mental health strategy, mental health resources, solutions, training for the managers, I think can really have a huge impact on your people because they're going to set the tone. So if they're coming to work every day on fire, in flames, that is going to set the tone for the rest of the team. And the rest of the team is going to feel like that is the expectation, that is the norm for them to be operating that way. So I think that if we can support managers, that can have a big impact on the rest of people.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear you say that. And actually, I will say that's probably top two things that we've heard from employers in terms of their identified needs on the mental wellness side today. What do you have to support managers? Because, and you and I were talking about this, you know, before the show, that, you know, today you feel like you have to be, we all feel like we have to be a therapist, a coach, a nurturing person, an assertive person, all of these different roles because people are just going through it these days. And like, they don't have the ability to separate the personal from the work as well as prior because, and I think to your point, at some point I heard you say this, a lot of them work at home. Like they don't even go into the office anymore. You know, there are all these reasons that those boundaries have been crossed. So to ask somebody to show up and be a robot today is not as realistic as it was 20 years ago.
Well, yes. And Laura, I'm just thinking about it. It goes both ways, right? So I gave an example of how my personal life is impacting my mental health, and that shows up at work. But it goes the other way, too. We know that burnout is rampant.
Yes.
And that is something that goes home with people also. So when we think about from an employer's perspective and what is their role and responsibility when it comes to employee mental health, No, you're not going to be able to solve everybody's problems, right? But it is in the best interest of employers to invest in helping their people to be okay across the spectrum of total well-being, because the more we can support individuals, the more of themselves they are going to bring to work every day. If they're sitting there struggling, worried about paying their bills, for example, they may have a big smile on their face and they may be in their seat at 8 a.m., but from an ability to focus, maybe they're in a position to be offering customer service, they're not going to be showing up as their best self. And I think that there is an acknowledgement and why we are seeing more folks asking for support as it relates to promoting mental health.
Yeah, you nailed that, because one of the things we also hear consistently is from employers, well, we're frustrated because we do offer support. And then we still have people coming to us saying, where's our support? And, you know, it's challenging because historically there was kind of like that one way that people would offer the mental health support, which was like really the crisis support and then the clinical support. But that's only 25% of the average workforce population today. There's another 75%. So that's 75%. And I would love to hear your thoughts on this. I don't know that 75% used to really care. Like they, you know, they didn't care if they had anything, right? Because it wasn't like the stigma was there. So it was, okay, the suck it up buttercup world we were still in. But I feel like now that 75% is, what have you done for me lately? What are you doing to help me stay well? What are your thoughts there?
So two thoughts on that. First of all, I think in terms of where are my mental health resources, one of the first things that we do when we come in to consult with clients is before we tell them they need something else, is we take an inventory of everything that they already have.
Smart.
And how are they packaging and positioning and communicating these resources to their people? That is huge. And it typically doesn't cost any money. It's just thinking a bit creatively, being a bit organized, and communicating the benefits and resources outside of once a year that often happens in tandem with open enrollment for their health insurance, for example. The challenge there is just by nature, open enrollment health insurance, it feels very cold and sterile already. So anything that you're communicating in that context is likely going to get lost in translation, plus the volume of information that is being communicated at that time. So thinking about year-round on a monthly or quarterly basis, for example, promoting the benefits and resources in a meaningful way and in the context of we care about you and your total well-being. So that would be one thought. The other piece is you mentioned folks may have some resources and benefits in place, and then everybody's like, well, that's not a match for what I need or for what I want. And I would think about it like in the context of financial well-being. If folks are offering a retirement plan and checking the box and saying we're supporting our people financially, there are a lot of people that are not in a position to be saving for retirement because they're worried about their day-to-day bills, expenses, and others. So you have to look at it across the spectrum. And the same goes for mental health as well. And that's what you, I think, were alluding to, Laura, too, is we offer an EAP. Okay, check the box. But I think it's important to really look at what is it that my people really want and value. And it used to be, we talked a little bit about generations. We would look at the breakdown of a workforce by generation and say, well, if you're millennials, then you care about your fur babies and you want pets. Generation X, you're worried about paying for your human babies for college. And that was how we would align our benefits.
Yeah.
But I think it's more complex, more multifaceted, because life is multifaceted. And
yes,
you alluded to that too. Doesn't matter how old we are, we're all experiencing life through these peaks and valleys. And it's not just about our career stage, but it's where we're at in our life. Think about all of the different life events, having a baby, adopting a pet, buying a new house, aging parents, a spouse loses their job. We could come up with a multitude of things. All of those things impact our people financially, mentally. We could probably create a physical tie as well. So I think we have to look at our workforce as a collective of individuals that are in a different place in terms of life's journey. And how can we really support them throughout that journey? Which sounds like a lot. And again, we can't solve everything. But I think we can ask, what is it that the people really want and value? One Digital just launched a pilot survey, the Employee Value Perception Study, that focuses in on asking individuals, what is most important to you? If employers are investing, allocating all of these resources, you have to choose, right? It's not about, oh, I would like a hot tub in the break room, please.
Yeah. But
realistically, would you rather higher compensation? Would you rather a higher match in your 401k? Or would you rather mental health benefits?
Right.
To really understand what is it that people really value?
Mental health challenges make up 10% of workplace healthcare costs and lead to billions in lost productivity each year. Traditional employee assistance programs were created to help address these challenges. However, they are often underutilized because they are focused on reactive solutions instead of proactive solutions. That's why we created Spearance, to prioritize mental wellness in order to prevent mental illness. Spearance's science-backed platform offers an extensive and continually growing library of mental health courses crafted and delivered by clinical experts. The platform also features live events, interactive coaching, on-demand support tools, and dedicated support for managers. Our approach results in over 800% higher utilization than traditional EAPs. The world is moving towards proactive care, and Spearance is leading the way. Spearance, the future of workplace mental health.
I'm glad you mentioned the survey, because I was going to ask you if you had any recommendations of surveys. I've heard a few employers say that they've launched surveys, but I think even that is something for the average HR director. You know, not every company has the opportunity to have a dedicated wellness team.
Yes.
You know, where all they do is do that.
Correct. And, you know, I would argue that it's gone beyond what is our wellness strategy? What is our wellness budget? What are our wellness resources? To really thinking about it from a broader organizational perspective. What is our overall engagement strategy?
Yes.
That's like, what is our people strategy? Because I think it is so much bigger now than healthy meals in the break room and a walking program.
Well, it is. I mean, I'll give you an example. Spearance is owned by a family office that owns a variety of companies, and there's, you know, just under 500 employees. So we have a benefits package, and, you know, I'm sure you're the same in your work. As we were building Spearance, I always try to put myself, and our team does, in the employee's shoes. And it's, we're not going to build something that we wouldn't use ourselves.
Yes.
You know, and so, and really being honest about that. It's like, and just today I get an email, we might have to crop this out. This might get me in trouble because it's nothing. I'm not going to say what the benefit was, but it was a very lengthy email for me to complete a challenge. And this was on, you know, a different type of benefit, not mental health, not anything, but it was, I literally am zooming in because the print was so small. And there were so many steps, and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to be doing that, even though I want to, because, you know, I'm in my employee brain, because
yes.
I'm an employee, but I also run our wellness company, you know, our mental wellness company. So of course I want to lead the charge and I want to do this, but this is about 8 steps and it's really fine print and I have to log in somewhere and I'm not going to do it. So It's like making things accessible for people with today, with how we all learn today, how we all do yes. things today. I also think that's challenging too, because you do have, I mean, we think we're quick, Shira, with technology. Like, look at these generations two behind us. Like, they're like, you guys don't know what you're doing. Like Peja, the producer of this show, he's like, Laura, like, what? I'm like, I think I'm tech savvy. I'm not.
I'm the opposite. I would tell you that I'm not, and that I'm good at toys, is what I would say. But, yeah.
See, you're just honest. I'm fooling myself. Well, yeah.
I try to be.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about these tedious tactical points programs, and it makes me think about, are you familiar with the term well-being washing?
No.
Washing. Okay.
No.
So basically, the term refers to employers being more focused on having the illusion of caring about their employee well-being mm-hmm. than actually focusing on their employee well-being.
Yeah.
And some examples of this might be, we want to offer this program that fits very nice and neatly in a box, and we get all these nice, pretty graphs and reporting that shows how many points all of our people have earned.
Right.
When in reality, our people might be struggling and suffering with burnout because they're overworked and the company's focused on trying to sustain themselves as a business. They're short-staffed. And right. here you are introducing this wellness program where I have to take 47 minutes out of my day to manage and track my points. Like, it doesn't add up, right?
Yeah.
So it's focusing on what is it. I think the other example you mentioned was with managers, like management training. That's not exactly sexy when you think about wellness initiatives.
Yeah.
But it's something that can have a tremendous impact on your people day to day. Is it going to be harder to quantify and measure? Yes. But the value of something like that, where people feel, we haven't even gotten into things like psychological safety, where they feel like my company cares because my supervisor cares about me. Those are the types of things that don't cost a lot of money, but can really have a tremendous impact.
I love that you mentioned psychological safety, because that is something that I think the average employer can use more education about what that means in action.
Yes.
Because I think it's one thing to have the knowledge and the education, and then there's another thing that to have simple action steps and to have that broken down for someone to say, okay, if I do A, B, and C, I'm going to get a better result. Oh, wow, it's that simple. And can you think of an example of a time that you've seen something implemented or a tool that people have just raved about that it's been like, wow, that was simple, but it made a huge impact?
So, okay, one of the things you said about psychological safety, it's one of those terms that I think people would, if we're being honest, would kind of cringe or shy away from. But in practice, if you didn't use that term, people would agree with all of the principles, because it's logical and it makes perfect sense. It's things like creating an environment where people feel safe to speak up and offer their opinion, to ask yeah. questions, to make mistakes, and then ultimately offer up a new way to do things. Who doesn't want that on a team, right? In terms of yeah. When you're problem solving and trying to be innovative, those are things that make logical, practical sense. So just don't label it. You know, it's like back in the old days when we would come into like a manufacturing employer or employer that was traditionally had a large male population. And the whole idea of wellness with some of the now older generations was something that they would shy away from. But if you called it their risk management and safety program, that was acceptable to engage and participate in terms of their culture. This is a so simple. I can't think of anything easier, but just taking a pulse, if you're leading a meeting, whether it's virtual or in person, taking a pulse on a room, like, how is everybody doing today? And you can even limit it to like a thumbs up, thumbs down, or like a so-so. But it shows that you care. It also gives you a tempo in terms of the room that you're experiencing. And it just allows people to kind of slow down and acknowledge and be authentic.
Yeah.
In terms of where they're at. I've been at One Digital for 7 years, and they've actually just rolled out a leadership training course that is tremendously focused on EQ, on emotional intelligence, because of how important it is when it comes to people saying they want to stick around and work for an employer, for people to say, yes, I feel like my employer cares about my health and well-being.
Yeah.
A lot of it has to do with the manager, and a lot of managers have not had any management training. They get promoted into a manager role because they're really good at their job. But in terms of experience, having like crucial conversations, like you mentioned, Laura, or knowing and understanding what to do if you have an employee that maybe they're not meeting expectations, focusing in on the performance versus the person is a missed opportunity to show that you care and you're concerned.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned emotional intelligence. Well, first of all, I think any person I've talked to that works at One Digital loves working at One Digital. So you guys are doing something right.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. But it is important. I mean, you know, as we build spirits and we're building the culture here, it's like we have to practice what we preach, and we hold each other accountable to that. You know, it's like we can't be out there teaching something that we're not doing. And you guys, I mean, really, I have not met. And then a lot of you work long term there, I feel.
Yes.
Which is another sign. So that's fantastic. But emotional intelligence, I think, is also one of those words that people know, but they don't know what it looks like in action in the workplace. We actually have a guest slated for the podcast who's a nationally recognized author in it, because I think it's so important.
Awesome.
In terms of, yeah, I'm like, I don't know him very well, but I can't wait to interview him.
Yes.
I'm like, give us tips. Like,
I'll be tuning in for that one for sure.
Yeah, because it's something that, you know, I think a lot of people think they practice. I mean, you and I could think we have it, but there's always areas of improvement. There's always those little tips that, you know, can shift everyday interaction, which is what I heard you say before. It can shift everyday interaction. I think we've also had, I don't know about you, but we've talked to a lot of HR leaders who, what we were saying, they feel like they have to be therapists. They feel like they have to be this. They feel like that because it's like giving even that layer tools to navigate the insanity,
yes,
let alone they have the responsibility of choosing the benefit. So what do you what would be your message to HR leaders today, just in general, of whether you have empathy for them, whether you have like a great insight for them? What's your message?
First of all, I think we're so lucky to have them, because they are truly, we mentioned sandwich generation earlier. I mean, they're sandwiched between caring about their people and also being tasked with helping to sustain their business. I think my message to them would be, don't feel like you have to choose anymore. Taking care of your people will help sustain your business. It's the best thing you can do for your business, is to take care of your people. And I think when you experience employees that are struggling, oftentimes the first thing that you might notice is that from a performance perspective. But be curious, because oftentimes that's what you recognize, but it might be the result of somebody that's struggling from a mental health and well-being perspective. And if you're curious and you show compassion and caring, you might have the opportunity to help offer support and resources to that individual as opposed to just turning it into a performance conversation. And sometimes those need to happen too.
My goodness, that is so true. That is that's a beautiful message. I also want to pull in what we talked about earlier, that even as an employee, you know, if you are having a conversation with the HR, that's an opportunity too to think about what your needs are as an employee. Like, how often do we really stop and think about that? It is nice just to sometimes talk about it and have it acknowledged that you're going through this as, you know, in my personal life. But sometimes, let's say it's a medical diagnosis. Let's say it's a death of a loved one. You know, there might be specific needs. Look, I'm planning for the funeral. And, you know, so is it okay if I'm not, you know, in whatever that is, or I have a medical diagnosis, I have to now do physical therapy once a week. I will do my best to have it not affect performance, you know, but that gives that manager or that HR team the opportunity, to your point, give resources. So I think it's like that educational piece on both sides, like for HR teams, but also the employee to be empowered to have the language and the skills to communicate their needs and to know that that's okay. And then, so I do want to talk about the sandwich generation, because yes, that's been referenced several times. So what does that mean to you? Because I know I saw a post on your LinkedIn that I really connected with. I have colleagues and I have peers who I know would connect with that as well, who've gone through some really difficult things. I'm a person in my 40s as well in the workforce, and there's a lot between, I mean, let's, you know, we've even talked about perimenopause and menopause on this show already, and how that shows up for people. But I think that caring for our parents' generation and all that comes with that is going to be an increasingly large stressor for the sandwich generation.
Yes. So yes, I'm mid-40s, exactly mid-40s, if you will. And I also have an almost 3-year-old. And also, and
my parents. Oh my goodness.
So you'd miss me on the generational slide, right? Because all of the things that you're supposed to be.
You combine too. You just went and put yourself in two categories.
Right. Yes. So almost 3-year-old. And then I had written a post on LinkedIn about the challenge of aging parents and just that balance between, and on top of my day job, of course, worrying about my parents, wanting to help take care of my parents, also wanting and needing to take care of my child and kind of feeling pulled in so many different directions. I want to go be with my parents, but I don't want to leave the baby. And if I bring the baby, then I'm not any help to my parents. And also selfishly, my parents are missing out on grandparenting. And I'm missing out on, you know, date nights because not having those parents. So that's speaking about it really superficially. But it's just the constant, like, you can't be in so many places all at one time, and adding to some of the stress when it comes to mental health, feeling like there's not enough hours in the day, sleep, you're not successful as a parent, you're not being successful at work, you're not being successful taking care of your parents, just being realistic in terms of expectations, I think, is something that you just never know what people are going through. I just lost my dad, and I remember going through the airport thinking to myself, nobody knows what it is that I'm experiencing right now. And how many times have I walked by people at work, in the airport, at the gym, driving past somebody in traffic that did something I didn't like very much, and not been thoughtful about what they could possibly be going through. You just never know. That kind of is off in a different direction. But anyways.
Oh, Shira, I'm so glad that you mentioned all of that, because I think so many people can relate. I think everyone can relate. And I will say the hardest time I've seen colleagues go through, and I've had some losses, that have been made it tough to show up in the workplace. But I think a parent, there are connections that are a lot closer, losing a child, losing a parent, losing a spouse, and what that is like as an employee. Because so I guess my question is, what could the people around you have done better? Like in a perfect world, if you could have created a perfect scenario or could create during this time, because the thing is with grief and loss,
yes,
there it's not linear. Like there's no timeline.
That's
so
right.
It's never going to be over.
That's right. And everybody experiences it differently. For example, I'm thinking about other people close to me that maybe aren't as close to their parents, but they're going to experience grief differently in terms of maybe there's guilt involved, there's other feelings. So it's like you can never compare your experience to someone else's. There are tons Yep. of benefits, of course, from an employer perspective that can be helpful, things like caregiving benefits, certainly additional therapy, mental health access.
Yeah.
Employee resource groups where you can connect with employees that are experiencing similar things. All of those things can be tremendously helpful and beneficial. But I think beyond that is that culture of caring and the ability to be able to show up as your authentic self. And I've had to do that. I've had to excuse myself from meetings because out of nowhere, my emotions are just overwhelming and overtaking, and knowing that I have the support, that I'm not going to be reprimanded by my manager.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that I'm setting an example for my team that I want them to show up as their authentic self as well.
I think that's beautiful. I think that alone is so helpful to people, because you do see that. You see people trying to hold it in. You see people trying to show up and, kind of do the grind. And that, and we want to talk about preventive mental health. I mean, that's the kind of thing that does lead to depression.
Yes.
It does lead to the development of an anxiety condition.
The more chronic.
Yes.
We did, as opposed to just something situational.
Exactly. But I mean, I think that's such a good point too, is a lot of people don't know how, because I mean, what do we have? We have like the stages of loss, stages of grief, like in terms of even education of what it's supposed to look like and what it's supposed to feel like. But to your point, it's never going to be that concrete because it's different in every situation and for every person. I love that we're talking about this, because I will say, as a colleague and as a manager, you do see this happen consistently.
Yes.
And I think even managers want to know how they can better support someone when they've lost someone,
Yes.
So did you take time off? How did that look?
It happened to be over the holidays, so I did have the opportunity to take some time off. But I think to your point, Maura, I think I was still in shock. So it's something that some days I'm okay, and other days I have permission to say I'm not okay. I need to take time, or just to check in and ask, how are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
I think can be really helpful and meaningful.
Right. And acknowledging, even long after the fact, that something like that has happened.
Yes.
But acknowledging that that's still going to be a thing for them.
Right.
And
because
like
everybody's still living their life, right? And everybody has stuff.
Yeah.
And so there comes a time where people stop asking, right?
Yes.
Not because we don't care, but just
I agree with you.
They've got their own stuff going on, or they ask how are you doing, or how was your weekend, or how was your vacation, and that's totally normal and well intended. But for me, like, I've had to figure out how to navigate that, because the real answer is I'm hanging in here. Sometimes I'm okay. Like, I'm fine when I'm fine, and I am not.
Which is not normal. I mean, and that's really the thing, is it's like, oh no, I'm actually still not doing okay. You know, and like being okay with that, because I also have a 3-year-old child, you know. I mean, and I think that's the same with so many of these challenges. And I will say, for the sandwich generation, because it's also for the women, it's the hormones, for men, it's a lot of them are getting burned out.
Yeah.
In their careers at this age.
Yes.
And so it's like, okay, like, are we cool with saying we're not okay? Because actually the generation ahead of us needs us. You know, we can be a leader for them in that. Mm-hmm. And we can be a leader for these younger generations, the ones that we're managing. So I really am so glad that we met, Shira.
Same.
I really appreciate this conversation. I mean, I told the producers, okay, shut the show down. But because I told them when we started doing this, I'm not doing a boring show. Like, these are real people. These badasses in the corporate wellness space are real people too. And because they're real people, they are helping shape the future of corporations and the health of corporations, because giddy up. Business is going to get tougher because the world is getting tougher. So we have to, as corporate wellness professionals, help organizations toughen up in the right ways in the right areas. Thank you for your time today, Shira. And thank you all for joining another episode of Prevention Pioneers. We hope to see you back again soon. Thank you.